The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is New York State Senator Liz Krueger, a Democrat serving New York's 28th District on the east side of Manhattan. Welcome back, Senator Krueger. It's always a delight to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Alan.
So how's it going?
You know, 2019 so far has been a great experience as a Democrat in the New York State Senate. We took the majority, as you know, in the last election cycle, and we had 15 brand new senators when I got to Albany in January, and we literally had a bell go off, and we started running, and we passed, by most people's analysis, the most activist and accomplished legislative session in 50 years. And so I've sort of been on a high now for months and months and months from what we finally showed we were able to do and could do. And frankly, nothing motivates like success. So we're all pretty damn excited about starting 2020 as well.
So how are you getting along with the two other players? Because it is a tripart system. Obviously, the assembly, number one, and the governor, number two. So, you know, you pass the legislation, but does it get passed?
So I think that what people also who were watching saw was that the Assembly under Speaker Carl Hastie and the Senate under Andrea Stewart-Cousin had an enormous amount of congeniality and ability to get bills passed both houses. I believe the count is we passed 957 two-house bills this year. And I think that's probably some kind of record, especially when you looked at how many of those bills were substantive policy changes for the state, not just renewals of every two-year type bills. So the two houses work together in a way I'd never seen in my 17 years before this in Albany. The governor is the executive, so he's his own one-man show, and to some degree, through both institutional structure and I think some ideology, he thinks his job is to be counter whatever we try to get done on a lot of the issues, you know, and I get it. I mean, legislatures and their executives always seem to have power struggles. I think that now that we're all Democrats, it would be lovely if we could figure out how to dance together more smoothly and effectively in the coming years. And I don't give up hope that that can happen.
Well, okay, so I've been watching this, as you know, as you've been watching this, and there were many people who thought both Mario Cuomo, Andrew Cuomo's father, and Andrew Cuomo, had a special fondness in their hearts for the Republicans, who would slow things down, and they would be able to say to the progressive folks like yourself, you know, the Republicans won't let us do it. But now the Republicans aren't there for a number of reasons. And the question is Andrew missing the old days of the Republicans slowing him down? Because he did have that group of, people who were supporting Democrats, who were supporting the Republicans and keeping them in office. But there came a point where that wasn't going to wash anymore. So with my little speech ended now, how is that all working out?
Well, I have to say, listening to your show, you seem to be having more conversations with the governor than any legislators I know. So I would suggest you ask him that question. I don't know.
I've asked him, Liz. I have asked him that question. He pretends he doesn't know what I'm talking about. But from your perspective, and that's why you're the guest and I'm the interlocutor. The question is, and you've always been very honest and very good, and that's why we love having you. You know, I mean, There must be some very interesting conversations going on between you and the leaders of your house, and whether or not he can be conformist to genuine democratic principles.
Yes, I think there is an ongoing set of conversations, not necessarily consistent, but where all of that comes up as the subtext of where we are on any given issue or on any given bill. I know that just as an example, one of the places that I think we could absolutely make some progress in year two of this model is to have the governor's staff be willing and given permission, because I believe it would need permission by the governor, to discuss bills with both houses of the legislature before they're passed, so we can get a better understanding of where the governor might be in disagreement. So, for example, as you know, it can take you months and months, and in some cases years and years, to finally get a bill passed both houses. But the policy has been in this administration, only then will they, their agency commissioners, their counsel's office, weigh in and say, here's the problem we have with the bill. Here's where we don't think the bill's written technically or constitutionally correctly. Here's something that we would need to change in order to have the governor to sign the bill. They tell you that after you pass the bill and left session. I would love to be able, as the chair of a committee and the sponsor of a bill, to say, look at this bill. We're serious about getting it done. Both houses are serious. I would much prefer to pass a bill that the governor actually supports and agrees with and will work for you and your agencies. So please take a look and advise amendments now, instead of telling us why you're vetoing it after we've gone through the whole process of passing it in both houses and we've already left for the year, so we can't fix it then. It just seems like such a simple and easy way to resolve plenty of problems that aren't necessarily major ideological fights, but I totally get and respect there are reasons that a legislature might look at a solution to a problem and not necessarily understand from an agency perspective for operationalizing or from a governor's perspective that there's another way to do it. Let's just sit down and talk more about it. And obviously, I'm not expecting the governor and the two leaders to lock themselves in a room 24/7 to do this, but they all have representatives. The governor has an enormous staff of professionals. The legislature actually has an enormous staff of professionals. And I am more than happy to sit down and talk to anyone about any of my bills. I don't need to sit down with the governor to work out issues on everything. And I just think that would really not only help us get more work done for the state of New York, but it would be an easy way to show that the governor and the legislature can have a better ongoing relationship for tackling some of the bigger, more problematic issues.
Okay, Liz Krueger, don't think I'm lobbying you, because I'm not. But there's a story in the paper that said New York will prohibit not-for-profit, it's like WAMC, for example, from backing or fighting political candidates, even if existing federal restrictions on such behavior are weakened. What are you trying to get done here?
So that's what's called the Johnson Amendment, which was signed by the governor. It was my bill and Amy Paulin's bill, signed by the governor, I believe, 2 days ago.
Right.
And that was basically in response to the fear that President Trump would undo a 60-year precedent of federal law saying that that not-for-profit 501c3 organizations may not take contributions and spend them on participating in political campaigns.
Right.
It's not that you can't, as a not-for-profit, be issue-driven. Of course, they are by definition. And it's not that you can't lobby, which, of course, they can. They have to file as lobbyists, but they can lobby. But it's to make sure that you're not using religious and other not-for-profit organizations as secondary campaign committees. And the Trump administration has consistently talked about wanting to undo that existing law and open it up. And most religious institutions and other not-for-profits actually have voiced strong support for doing this. They want to keep themselves out of that role. So I'm very proud of that bill. It's not an emergency bill at this point until such time as the Trump people actually reverse themselves or succeed in reversing Washington, and hopefully they won't. But I think it was a smart, proactive, let's protect ourselves and our institutions here in New York.
Okay. So you've mentioned and referenced, and I'm sorry for my ignorance, the Johnson Amendment. Who's Johnson?
Yes. Oh, damn.
Because I couldn't tell whether it was Lyndon Johnson.
I think it was actually under Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah. It could be. Yeah, it could be.
I think it was during the Johnson era, but I would now have to look up whether it's conceivable it was a different Johnson. Your listeners are going to go, boy, that Kruger person really doesn't know her stuff.
No, she does know this, her stuff, because she's the good Kruger. The bad one went to jail. I don't know what became of him after that. So my question...
Well, he's actually considering running for New York City Council.
Yeah.
So please, any listeners from Brooklyn, never ever let Carl Kruger, no relationship, be elected into any political system. Yes, it was the Johnson Amendment with Lyndon Johnson.
Okay, so let's go into...
And it was put into the U.S. tax code in 1954.
Gotcha. Boy, you're good. Okay, so now let's go to the Catholic Church, putting a face on it. They say never elect, if they say never elect this guy because he's for, abortion. Would that be an example of the church, a not-for-profit, using its power to endorse somebody, and which would be prohibited under your bill?
So if it was the church itself, the diocese, who was spending money to invest in campaigns pro or con someone, yes, that would violate Johnson Amendment. If it was a specific person who's a clergy member in this giant institution of any organized religion, who said in their church on a specific day, I don't think you should vote for this person because of X. No, I do not believe that would rise to the level of violating the law.
Okay, so Liz Kruger. They're not investing
in campaigns.
Right. So here's what I worry about, obviously, because I always worry about me. And that is, I shoot off my mouth. I say, this is wrong. This is right. We're a not-for-profit.
Yep.
People give us money. Would this bill affect us?
No. And in fact, the Johnson Amendment exists for you already. It's at the federal level. So we're putting the state law to match the federal law into effect in case the feds reverse themselves. So if nobody's come after you for any of the things you've been doing up until now since 1954, I don't think you're going to see a problem because we've now implemented it as a state-level law.
Well, we don't, of course, endorse candidates. We never do. So let's start to talk about the New York State's attempt to get the Trump state tax returns. And the issue, of course, is whether the president could be arrested and indicted if he shot someone on Fifth Avenue, if you're following me, because this has been much in the news. Yes.
It's actually fairly mind-boggling that this is the level of discussion we have coming in and out of the White House and as the president of the United States. So we did pass a law saying that New York State can turn over the New York State taxes of Mr. Trump, not to you or me, not to the public.
But to my congressman, Richie Neal.
Committees of Congress, that's right, if they request it because it's within their federal authority to be able to have access when they ask to these documents. And since at the federal level appears the administration's refusing to cooperate vis-a-vis the IRS, that committee could, in fact, ask New York State to share the documents that we have, which are the state taxes, not the federal taxes.
And Richie Neal, my congressman, who I very much like, decided not to do that for whatever his reasons were. Were you disappointed?
I was, but I always try to be cautious about perhaps I don't understand either the strategy or the law. I was told by another congressperson who may or may not be in the know that the reason that they didn't ask was they still have a lawsuit pending mm-hmm. on the right to get it from the IRS, and they felt that if they got it from the state, it would establish the precedent somehow that they didn't have the right to get it from the federal IRS.
Okay, so
I don't know if that's true, and I'm not an attorney on these cases.
So some senators, including yourself, have pressed the Comptroller DiNapoli on fossil fuel divestment. I've been asking him about that for many, many years as we have conversations on this very show. And usually he says, he does what he does because his bottom line is getting a return for the taxpayers of New York State. He doesn't want to prohibit himself from getting that. I don't want to misquote him. But what do you make of that?
So the Comptroller and I, who are, for the record, good friends, who don't agree on everything, don't agree on this. And we have had endless conversations about why I disagree with him. And he, and I also understand his argument against my bill is primarily he doesn't want to establish any precedent where the legislature could tell the controller who has sole fiduciary responsibility for the pension funds. He doesn't want to set a precedent where the legislature tells him what he can and cannot invest in. Yeah. I continue to take the position publicly. Fine, he could divest without our passing a law. Then I won't need to pass a law, and we'll both feel like we accomplished what we needed to accomplish. He would continue to show he didn't need the legislature inserting themselves, and I would be able to continue to show and argue, as I do, that it is bad public policy to use public funds to invest in the worst fossil fuel companies. We are now going down the road where we see more and more countries, cities, major financial institutions responsible for investing huge amount of money who are formally divesting from these companies. In fact, I have a new version of the bill which strengthens the constitutional arguments for why this is not only appropriate but almost necessary for the legislature to do, but also allows more flexibility to the controller to define the companies as being a problem or not. I'm going to be sharing that with the controller's office and then filing it as a bill in the next few days. And I would be happy after that to come back on and discuss any details about the new bill. While I think it's a stronger bill for the state of New York, while respecting concerns that the Comptroller's office has raised to me, and I think is a win-win. And maybe he and I won't be in disagreement sometime soon.
That'd be nice. Done. You're so invited. Early voting starts Saturday. Some lawmakers are still not happy with it.
Some people still aren't happy with it, you
yes,
said?
Yes, right.
Well, it's new, and we have lots of tests to be done on it. So is it rolling out as big as some of us would like? No, I would like more sites to be open. I think my whole district only has 7 sites for early voting. And when you understand New York City, that's a lot of people. I think that there are other ways to improve on it in future years. I know that depending on your county and area of the state, you have more or less concerns about how it's going to work. And I suspect we're going to all look very carefully at how it goes this year mm-hmm. and make adjustments that make sense for everyone in coming years.
Now, Liz Krugel, let's face it. It's good for the Democrats, bad for the Republicans, isn't it? I mean, more Democrats.
Isn't that a shame? It's bad for Republicans if more people vote. That's a statement that the Republican Party needs to deal with, not make it tougher for people to vote.
Which is why they're always against this kind of thing, isn't it?
Well, I know they say that, but, you know, again, whether a Democrat or Republican, as someone who believes in democracy and participation, personally, it's a very sad statement on any political party who would believe it's in the best interest of government to see fewer people vote.
So
I actually don't care if a Republican said it or a Democratic said it. To some degree, shame on all of you.
Okay, so
if you don't recognize that it's better for us all if more people vote. Is there analysis that in some areas, more people voting will mean more Democrats voting? Well, if I'm a Republican, I'm disturbed by that. But I would argue if you're a Republican and you haven't figured out how to step away from the president and demand change in your own party process, you know, you have much bigger problems than early voting.
So Nita Lowey's seat is up for grabs. State Senator David Carlucci, David Buchwald, and Mondaire Jones, who ran against Lowey before, are contesting. You got a favorite?
No, I don't. It's not my territory. I know two of the three. I know the two legislators. I don't know the third person. And I would suspect now that it's an open seat and it's a while away, we'll probably see more. I think we're seeing many contested primaries in not just open seats, but other congressional seats and Senate and Assembly seats. I think it's a response to what's happening in Washington, how many more people are becoming aware of the problems when you aren't making sure you have the people you believe in elected office. You know, while I know as an elected official, nobody ever wants to deal with primaries or generals, with all due respect to everyone, including myself, too bad. That's the model we're in. And it's good for democracy. Not any individual, not any party. It's good for democracy when more people are aware of what's going on, where more people who are dissatisfied, instead of just tweeting about it, actually say, I'm going to put myself on the line. I'm going to try to convince people I have better answers. I'm going to ask them to vote for me. It's even good when they try and they lose if they successfully raise consciousness and awareness of important issues. Because I'm guaranteeing you, any incumbent who has to face a primary or general and wins is going to be very astute about what were the issues that people were unsatisfied about in their races, and that's good for us all also.
Now, Liz Krueger, I only have 3 minutes left, so you have to go very, very, very quickly. Okay, ready? Here we go.
Okay.
Public campaign financing, there's a commission that's supposed to come up with it. There was a poison pill put in about fusion voting, which some people thought was against the Working Families Party, trying to get rid of it by the governor. What do you think?
I'm very disheartened by anything this commission is likely to do based on recent information. I don't believe it should be stepping into the fusion voting question. That's a separate issue than a public financing model and was not even on the table of a discussion when the commission was proposed or created. I'm not a big believer in commissions that make these decisions.
Right.
We're the legislators. We should vote up or down. It's fine to have task forces and blue ribbon commissions who make advice, but the decisions should be made by the legislature. But it was thrown into the budget, and we did this way.
Okay.
And I think we will live to regret it.
Yeah.
And the meanwhile, the proposals I'm hearing are coming out aren't going to give us a public financing system that work. And I believe in low donor matching public financing. I absolutely believe in it. But at least based on the stories I read this morning, the proposal will be impossible to actually work. And so maybe this is a plot to have the whole thing blow up. And I suspect that's what's going to happen.
You think the governor wants that? Yes or no, because we have no more time. Yes or no, you think the governor wants this to blow up?
I feel like that's the storyline. But I've had no conversation.
Okay, let's talk about marijuana. We only have 2 minutes. Is this going to happen? You met with the New Jersey and the Pennsylvania and the Connecticut. Whereas meantime, we in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, where I live, we love it. You know, we got an extra $1 million this year. What do you think?
So I was at the Weed Summit of four governors, plus Massachusetts was there, Rhode Island was there, Colorado was there, with experts sharing their experiences. I was very encouraged by the level of engagement by Governor Cuomo on getting this done and the level of engagement of the other three governors, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Connecticut. I do think there is a logic to a regional approach, even if it's not identical state to state, to have a regional approach from the Northeast. The fact that Massachusetts, your home state, has gotten there first and was there to share experience so far. Colorado's experience is invaluable because they now have 7 years of experience under their belt, and they've been making adjustments to their original law as they have moved forward. I am far more optimistic we're going to get it done here in New York in 2020 than I was before last Friday's summit.
Here we are. We're out of time. Our guest has been the wonderful New York State Senator Liz Krueger, who always speaks her mind, tells you the truth as she sees it. Liz, so thanks so much for joining us. It's always fun, and can't wait to have you back again.
Thanks so much, Alan. Take care.